Chapter 15, Initiation and an Invitation. The Bhutanese Gompa was situated not far from the old Bhutan palace, and like the latter, it must have been built 100 or more years ago, when Kalimpong was still part of Bhutan. A square, solid-looking structure with a corrugated iron roof, the Gompa stood flanked by a few dark pines in the middle of its modest compound, which was surrounded by a low stone wall. The place had a deserted, neglected look. Except for the caretaker, who was rarely seen, it was unoccupied. Nothing ever happened there, it seemed, and in the course of my years in Kalimpong, I had only once been inside the shabby old building, the doors of which were kept firmly shut. One day I heard that an incarnate lama was staying at the Bhutanese Gompa. I don't remember if his name was mentioned to me at the time, though even if it had been mentioned, it would have meant very little to me. Since the newcomer was an incarnate lama, it was not long before I went to see him, taking Praniloka with me as my interpreter. We found the lama living not at the Gompa, but in a small cottage situated just inside the compound gate, to the right of the path leading to the Gompa. As Praniloka explained the purpose of our visit, which was simply to pay our respects, I noticed that although the Rinpoche wore the maroon robe, he had the long hair that betokened the lay tantric yogi. I noticed also that he was exceptionally tall, for despite his being seated cross-legged on his bed, his grey head bent over the Tibetan xylograph volume in his lap, this was immediately obvious. When his wife came in with the customary Tibetan tea, she too turned out to be exceptionally tall, as did their two lanky grown-up daughters, who stood in the doorway for a few minutes, regarding the visitors with undisguised curiosity. The average height of this family of giants must have been nearly 6.5 feet. But the most remarkable thing about the Rinpoche himself was not his height, but his smile, which was of extraordinary sweetness, without the least trace of sentimentality, and seemed to come from within, suffusing his soft features with a kind of glow. How much I got to know about Dilgo Khenchi Rinpoche on that first visit, I cannot say. Perhaps he told me that he and his wife and daughters had arrived in Kalimpong only recently, having escaped from Tibet to Bhutan, whence they had made their way to Sikkim. He would not have told me that he was, as I later discovered, one of the 5 tulkus of the great Jamyam Khyentse Wangpo, one of the leading figures in the Rime, or non-sectarian, movement in 19th century Tibetan Buddhism, my own Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche being also one of the 5. He was therefore a very eminent lama indeed, and one who moreover was greatly revered by many people, especially those who were followers of the Kagyu and Nyingma traditions. Yet, despite his being so eminent a lama and so revered, it would have been difficult to find a more unassuming person than Dilgo Khenchi Rinpoche, or one who was more approachable. It was therefore not many months before I was visiting him regularly, accompanied sometimes by Praniloka and sometimes by Lobsang Norbu, for I never felt that I was being intrusive or that I was wasting the Rinpoche's time. On the contrary, I felt that I was more than welcome. I always found the Rinpoche sitting cross-legged on his bed, a Tibetan xylograph volume in his lap. On my entering the tiny front room, he always looked up from his book with a little smile of recognition and pleasure, and his wife always came in after a few minutes with the Tibetan tea and perhaps some Tibetan bread. After a few such visits, I observed that the Rinpoche never gave the impression of being disturbed or interrupted in what he was doing. His attention seemed to pass smoothly and seamlessly from one thing to another, as though all were equally interesting, equally important, and equally enjoyable, whether it was reading his book, answering a question from me, or drinking his tea. It was no different when, on the 9th of May 1963, he transmitted to me the POA, or Consciousness Transference, of Amitabha, an oral tradition of the Nyingma Pass. Once again, I was able to observe how seamlessly his attention passed from one thing to another, passing on this occasion from whatever it was he'd been doing before to the business of explaining to me the details of the practice and performing the simple ritual within whose context the transmission took place. The practice belonged to the Anuttara Yoga Tantra, Kenshi Rinpoche told me. It was an oral tradition, having never been committed to writing, and was the simplest and easiest of all Poa practices. It could be done anywhere and at any time, but for the time being at least, I was not to discuss it with anyone except Yogi Chen, though I was permitted to make notes for my personal use. Since the Poa included a visualization of Amitayus, the Buddha of eternal life, it was not necessary for me to do the long life practice separately. Though I was still visiting the Rinpoche regularly, it was not until the 6th of October that he visited the Vihara. Unfortunately, I have no recollection of this visit, though a note I made at the time informs me that we discussed the Tarpe Dilam, one of the texts I had chanced to come across after receiving the Padmasambhava initiation from Khatri Rinpoche. The author of the Tarpe Dilam was a celebrated Nyingma Lama, Kinshi Rinpoche informed me, and the text itself was very well known among Nyingma Pas. The work was written about 150 years ago, the author having died at the age of 87 in the early years of the reign of the 13th Dalai Lama. The latter had once expressed his regret at not being able to meet the author, as he himself lived in Lhasa and the author in Kham. 2 weeks later, on the 28th of October, Kenshi Rinpoche initiated me into the sadhanas of Kuru Kula, a dancing red Dakini form of Tara, and Jambala, the stout golden-yellow bodhisattva of material wealth and spiritual riches. Like the power transmission, the ceremony took place in the Rinpoche's room in the cottage inside the Bhutanese Gompa's compound. Since there are only three of us, the third person being my interpreter, and since the smallness of the room obliged me to sit quite close to the guru, an atmosphere of intimacy prevailed. Indeed, it did not feel like a formal initiation at all. As on the occasion of the Amitabha power transmission, Kenshi Rinpoche resembled an affectionate father who was telling his son, quietly and confidentially, something that would be of immense value to him throughout his life. Neither of the sadhanas required a full tantric abhisheka, only a lesser initiation or special kind of blessing. I had asked for them at the instigation of Yogi Chen, who was overjoyed that the power transmission had given me a spiritual connection with the great Dilgo Kenshi Rinpoche, and wanted me to strengthen the connection by taking further initiations from him. Kuru Kula and Jambala would help me in my work for the Dharma, he declared. Kuru Kula belonged to the Lotus family, of which Amitabha was the head. She embodied one of the four principal Buddha activities, that of attraction or fascination, the other three activities being, respectively, those of maturation, pacification, and destruction. Jambala belonged to the Jewel family, the head of which was Ratnasambhava. There were three Jambalas, Yogi Chen explained, the white, the yellow, and the black. The white Jambala was a Buddha, the yellow Jambala a bodhisattva of the eighth stage, appearing in the form of a god, and the black Jambala a Dharmapala, or protector of the Dharma. The yellow Jambala was the main one, and it was his sadhana that Kenshi Rinpoche would give me if I asked. The black Jambala was hardly Buddhist, for he was worshipped for the acquisition of wealth by forcible means. When the Dalai Lama needed money, he would get the bond priests to worship the black Jambala on his behalf. The white Jambala had a special connection with the Karmapa. October 1963 was an important month for me as regards initiations, especially as in the course of it I also received an initiation from Dalai Rinpoche. On the 25th of October, he initiated me into the sadhana of Vaidurya Prabha, or Blue Radiance, the blue-bodied Buddha of healing, which, like the Kurukula and Jambala sadhanas, required only a lesser initiation or special kind of blessing. I had been drawn to the figure of the Medicine Buddha, as he was also called, after reading a translation of the Chinese version of the Mahayana Sutra that bears his name. According to this popular scripture, prior to becoming a Buddha, he had made 12 vows, and it was by virtue of these vows that those who worshipped him were guaranteed healing. The fact that I was visiting Kenshe Rinpoche regularly, as well as Dato Rinpoche and Yogi Chen, meant that I often passed through the bazaar on my way to or from the Bhutanese Gompa, or the old Bhutan Palace, or the Five Leguminous Tree Hermitage. 9 months had passed since the withdrawal of the last Chinese troops from Indian territory, but signs of the alarm that the invasion had created were still to be seen. Chinese shops and business premises were still boarded up, and as far as anyone knew, their unfortunate owners still languished in an internment camp, or worse. But if there were no Chinese on the streets of Kalimpong, there were plenty of military personnel in their black berets and jungle greens. They came from the army camp which had been established at Rinkingpong, not far from the little Kagyu Gompa and Dudjun Rinpoche's unfinished temple, both of which were now difficult of access. One day I happened to pass to Jawans, as the ordinary soldiers were called, who, like myself, were on their way to the bazaar. "We've got the atom bomb," I heard one Jawan say to the other. "If the Chinese give us any more trouble, we'll drop it on Lhasa." India did not then have nuclear weapons, but the troops may have been told by their officers that she did have them in order to bolster their morale, which after their defeat at the hands of the Chinese was said to be very low. But if Mother India did not have the atom bomb, she had plenty of other weapons. Gazing down the hillside from the Vihara Garden, I could make out, far below, the ant-like procession of trucks, artillery, and even tanks crawling along the road that zigzagged its way from Tisa Bridge up to Kalimpong. As I discovered when I made an unscheduled flying visit to Darjeeling, Tisa Bridge itself was now protected by a battery of anti-aircraft guns, their barrels protruding disconcertingly from their half-camouflaged emplacement beside the road, and on both sides of the river there were swarms of green-clad Jawans. The flying visit was on account of Lobsang Norbu. At breakfast that morning, I had been told that the Vihara's young manager had disappeared. Inquiries revealed that he and a good friend of his who worked at Arunachal had talked of joining the irregular force that Jigme Norbu, the Dalai Lama's eldest brother, was organising for action against the Chinese troops in Tibet. According to Thubten, the two friends had probably gone to Darjeeling, where Jigme Norbu was based, in order to enlist. Even in the days of Hindi Chini Bye Bye, there had been a surreptitious trickle of men and money from India to the legendary Kamba guerrillas. And now that India and China were no longer such good friends, the operation could be carried on much more openly, albeit without the official sanction of the Indian government. Jigme Norbu's agents would travel round the area meeting young Tibetan men. They would talk to them about the importance of carrying on the armed struggle against the Chinese occupation, appeal to their patriotism, and finally assure them that if they volunteered, they would be properly trained and equipped. Apparently, Lobsang and his friend had been recruited in this way. On arriving in Darjeeling, I went straight from the motor stand to the foreigner's registration office, but no Lobsang Norbu had reported there, I was told. This left me wondering how best to continue my search for the runaway, and in the end I decided to consult a Bengali friend who had a watch repair shop on the main road into the town. I had not gone more than 100 yards in that direction when I saw coming towards me through the crowd the familiar figure of Lobsang. He was not surprised to see me, nor was he surprised when I gave him a good scolding for having left the Vihara without telling me or anyone else that he was going, which was hardly in accordance with Tibetan good manners. That afternoon he accompanied me back to Kalimpong and the Vihara. Though I admired the courage of the Kambas and other guerrillas, I believed that the cause for which they were fighting was a lost one, and I did not want to see Lobsang or any other young Tibetans sacrifice their lives for such a cause, however noble they might believe it to be. Lobsang later told me what he had learned about Jigme Norbu's force of irregulars. Those who volunteered to fight the Chinese were flown to a foreign country. He did not know the name of that country, but it was very far away, and the people there spoke English. The volunteers spent 3 months in that country. They were well treated and were taught how to use rifles and other weapons. He did not know what happened to the volunteers once they had completed their training. No doubt some way was found of getting them into Tibet so that they could fight the Chinese. When I repeated to the Kazini what Lobsang had told me, she expressed a degree of scepticism. She doubted if Jigme Norbu's guerrillas were trained in an English-speaking country. It was more likely, in her opinion, that the training took place at an American base, where, of course, English would be spoken. The base was probably located somewhere in Pakistan. As I knew, the Kazini was more favourably disposed to Pakistan than to India, and the fact that it was cooperating with the Tibetan diaspora against communist China would certainly have done it no harm in her eyes. Since the events of the previous year, she was more critical of India than ever, and would not have been sorry had her friend General Karyapa led a military coup against the corrupt and inefficient Congress government, as at one time it was rumoured he might. The Kazini was also tired of living in Kalimpong. The place had changed, she declared, and she would have left had she not been married to the Kazi, and had the Kazi not been married to his politics. Kalimpong had indeed changed in the course of the last few years. The fresh influx of Tibetan refugees, the rumours of impending invasion by the Chinese, and the presence of troops and tanks on the streets had all affected the atmosphere of the town. What was more, the authorities had become more suspicious of foreign visitors, especially Europeans and Americans, seemingly finding it difficult to believe that anybody could come to Kalimpong simply for the sake of the view. This meant that one's movements were watched, one's letters were intercepted, and though personally I had nothing to fear, I was glad that I now had a British passport. I had not always had a passport. On my going forth as a homeless wanderer on the 18th of August 1947, I had not only given away my worldly possessions, not only donned the traditional saffron robes of the world renunciant, I had also destroyed my identification papers. Like the friend who went forth with me, I believed that nationalism was one of the greatest evils of the modern world, and that in becoming a homeless wanderer, I had renounced not only all domestic ties and social obligations, but all national loyalties as well. Believing this as I did, I had vowed never to admit to having any particular nationality. I was a citizen of the world. It was not long before I found it impracticable to maintain, in all its youthful uncompromisingness, the attitude I had adopted. World citizens belonged to an ideal realm, not to the real world. Much as I might believe that I had no nationality, there were plenty of people, not all of them officials, who believed that I did have a nationality and wanted to know what it was. In the end, more than 2 years after my going forth, I wrote to the UK High Commissioner in New Delhi, asking him to place my name on his record of UK citizens. This he did, giving me a serial number and requesting me to notify any change of address. For the next 10 years, his letter served me in lieu of a passport, and whenever I was required to give my passport number, I gave my serial number on the High Commissioner's Record of Citizens. In 1962, I applied for a passport. The reason I applied for one was that the English Sangha Trust had invited me to spend some time in England, and I had accepted the invitation. In accepting it, I had made it clear that I would not be staying for more than 4 months, possibly six. At the time, I saw myself as being permanently settled in India, which I had come to regard as my spiritual home. In Kalimpong, within sight of the snows, I had a peaceful hillside hermitage, the Triyano Vardhana Vihara, where I could meditate, study, write, and receive my friends, and from which I sallied forth on my preaching tours in the plains, and to which, when I needed to recoup my energies, I could return. Above all, I had spiritual teachers of exceptional attainments, with most of whom I was in regular personal contact, and from whom I derived not just knowledge but inspiration. Thus, there was little incentive for me to return to the land of my birth, much as I loved its language and its literature, and at first I was undecided whether or not to accept the Trust's invitation. Kantipala was with me when it arrived, however, and when he pointed out that it was my duty to help spread the Dharma in England, inasmuch as I had been born and brought up there, I could not but recognise the force of his argument. I also reflected that the trip would enable me to see my parents and my sister, as well as to meet the various English Buddhists with whom I was in communication. Between my acceptance of the English Sangha Trust's invitation and my departure from India, there was an interval of 2 years. During this period, the greater part of my time was spent meditating, or writing, or visiting such of my teachers as were in Kalimpong. I also went on a short preaching tour in the plains, leaving the Vihara in the care of Tian Chao, who was paying his annual visit to the hills. On my return, some weeks later, I found that thieves had broken into my room the night before, and that 7 silver puja bowls were missing from my personal shrine. Tian Chao, Lobsang, and Thubten were asleep at the time and had heard nothing. When I told the Qazi and Qazini what had happened, the Qazini was horrified, but the Qazi took a more philosophic and more Buddhist view of my loss. The robbery was a good omen, he assured me, especially as my life was about to enter on a new phase. It meant that a karmic debt had been paid, and that I was now free to move forward without it hanging over my head. Dada Rinpoche, too, was concerned that I was free to move forward. He was concerned in particular that I should not be held back by any threat to my life force. Thus, he had given me, not long before, the Abhishekha of White Tara, the female bodhisattva of longevity, and with his help, I had started making an English version of the text of the relevant sadhana. I wanted to complete a first draft of this version before leaving for England, and the Rinpoche and I spent many hours working on the project together. We worked in the evening in the Rinpoche's quarters in the old Bhutan Palace, and sometimes it seemed that there were 3 of us in the room and that White Tara was looking down on our labours with a smile. We worked up to the very eve of my departure, so that when I packed my bag that night, I was able to include the exercise book containing the completed draft. The following morning, the Qazi and Qazini arrived with their jeep, having offered to drive me down to Siliguri and see me onto my train. As we left the Vihara, a Nepalese woman carrying a churn of milk happened to cross the road directly in front of us. This was a very good omen, the Qazi announced happily. My trip was sure to be a success. The End of Precious Teachers by Sangharakshita.